My mother believed and my father believed that if I wanted to be president of the United States, I could be vice president. This is
America. Former Vice President Joe Biden has been elected president of the United States.
It is my greatest honor and privilege to have been your president. We will be back in some form.
We are still deeply divided.
Public health experts warned this was coming unless more was done. And here we are now.
Are you proud of what happened here today?
Absolutely.
Never before in American history has there been an uprising like this.
Of the 75 million Americans who voted for Donald Trump, I don't know how many today are feeling, dear God, what was I thinking? But I would wager a lot more are thinking, let's carry on this fight.
Character matters. It matters. Tell them the truth matters.
The 21st century is going to be the American century. Because we lead not only by the example of our power, but by the power of our example. That is the history of the journey of America.
Marion McKeown, I have to start the show with an apology. Last week, you may remember, the members remember, that I said that most of the 70-year-olds I know I wouldn't trust with a shopping trolley. I walked back the comments
indeed, in the moment.
And I said to you,
you did indeed.
I said to you that perhaps there's such a thing as political fitness, and that the reason why America is so keen to elect people over the age of 70 to office is because that level of fitness is like a marathon runner, that it actually only arrives after decades of toil. You interviewed the woman with maybe the Kipchoge of political fitness, Nancy Pelosi. What was that experience like? And did you ask her about her political fitness?
Well, you know, she brought it up and it was really interesting. First of all, I have to say she is pretty formidable. Now, I've come across her before in group press conferences and in small groups and things like that. But she is quite something when you're sitting in her office with her, you know, across the way from her. First of all, the most gracious hostess you can imagine, you know, makes like really, you know, somebody who knows how to make people feel at ease. But she is tough.
Yeah.
She's tough as nails. And it's one of the things I think that people really admire about her, and even her foes, who are many. I mean, Nancy Pelosi is up there, and I would say even past Hillary Clinton in terms of the bête noire of the Republican Party, the people that Republicans just frigging love to hate. They loathe her because they fear her, because she is the most powerful woman in US politics and has been so for the guts of 20 years. Nobody has come close. And she's done it with an extraordinary amount of tenacity, toughness, and physical fitness. And, you know, we spoke about this in the context of Joe Biden's age and you know, the completely correct and understandable focus on that, because he does seem, as we have all seen at times, be missing a step. He seems frail and he seems very elderly. And she took a completely, as you might expect, opposite view and said that, you know, with this, you know, with the decades of battling in the House, the Senate, of working across the aisle, etc., you get experience. And she said, importantly, you get enough experience that you don't take it personally. Mm. When somebody shafts you politically, when somebody ridicules you, mocks you, does their damnedest to intimidate you, you roll with it. You realize that they're coming from a different place to you. And her view was that the reason Donald Trump is so, as she called it, mean, well, she called it other things as well, but the reason that she said he's so mean and vindictive is that he lacks that political experience. He came in cold from an office on Park Avenue or Fifth Avenue, where he was used to just yelling at everyone, and he just doesn't have the capacity to process the normal political cut and thrust, the normal things that happen in politics. And she said that's why he gets so angry, so belligerent, and tries to basically blunderbuss people instead of bringing them on side, because he tries to run politics the way he ran his business, which, let's face it, overall was not that successful.
Well, like, isn't that such an astute observation, but also kind of reflects another blind spot with her? Because in some ways I feel like that's one of the attractions for people, that he actually behaves like I would if I was in politics. They're like, you can't talk to me like that. You know, Nancy Pelosi would never say that. She'd know it's politics. He behaves like it's the playground. And you've offended my honor.
And that's what his supporters love. They don't want Mitt Romney. You know, they don't want Mitt Romney. They don't want a politician, a Republican old school politician. They wanted a street fighter when they picked Trump. So, and I think that that is the thing that he is. But I think it's also true to a degree that when you look at where it's got him objectively, if you just measure by the votes, and Nancy Pelosi is all about the votes. Nobody can count votes, really. I mean, she is. Even Republicans have said that to me several times. Look, you know, nobody counts votes like her. If she says there's X number, you can take that to the bank. But if you look at it in terms of the votes, he did lose the popular vote to Hillary Clinton by 3 million votes. There were Republicans who were trounced in the 2018 midterms, which nobody talks about. They lost 40 seats in Congress. Joe Biden lost, what, two or three or something, you know. He lost the 2020 election. Every candidate of his in the 2022 midterms, except for J.D. Vance, pretty much was laughed out of the election. So, you know, it's not that he has translated into a stellar political record. Yes, he's everywhere. You know, he's never off the cameras. He knows how to keep the ratings going. But he hasn't had much success as a politician, if you boil it down, apart from the extraordinary fact that in 2016, he did come in cold and, you know, he did become president. And so I think, you know, you can, with all politicians, you can argue the toss. And there are things, you know, exactly as you pointed out, that I, you know, we did say, well, you can't, he did become president, you know.
But it's how
he governed, I think, as president, that is, I think that what she was getting at, that he just didn't understand how politics worked. And I think probably in Trump's case, he doesn't want to. He doesn't have the patience. He doesn't care. As he sees it, the way he's doing it, it's just fine.
Well, he doesn't seem to understand how the law works either. He's got until Monday to pay $464 million in this bond. Now, we've talked about the bond a lot. He's been on the rampage this week saying how unfair it is, how this number is ridiculous, and that I might have to sell things to pay this. And then if I win an appeal, those things are gone. Does he have a point there?
I think he does. You know, I was looking up, you know, I'm a bit of a sad wonk when it comes to legal and constitutional
never, never
stuff.
Never marrying.
But there is a provision in the Constitution about cruel and unusual punishment and excessive fines. Now, let's just pretend this is not Donald Trump. Let's just pretend this is, pick another businessman. I was going to say Elon Musk, but there's so much for him out there. Willy Wonka. Okay.
Right.
So you and they did what Trump did, which was that they, you know, they fiddled the books, they fiddled the numbers, they pretended their properties were worth a lot more than they were to get these favorable loans.
Yeah.
Would, if they were fined this equivalent, the $450 million odd or whatever it was, the initial fine excluding the interest, would we think this was excessive? And I think we might. And I think the appeals court might just say, you know what? Yes, you're right to fine him. Yes, you found correctly in the case of Arthur Engoron's, you know, ruling and his judgment. But we think that this fine is disproportionate to the crime, to the fraud. And we think that it should be lower. And I think there's actually a very good chance that a New York appeals court could say, yeah, this is a bit excessive, because to me, I think it's excessive. Now, I believe that he is going to get this money. I think there's no doubt. Look, you know, of course he's going to cry foul. I've no money. It's got to be in by Monday morning. I'm pretty sure something's going to be there by Monday morning, because if it isn't, then he can't appeal. So I think a couple of things could happen here. Either Letitia James, the Attorney General, could say, okay, we'll give you another 30 days, because it's no skin off her nose. You know, this isn't like the E. Jean Carroll money, where E. Jean Carroll was a victim of appalling behavior by Donald Trump, not just in the fact that the jury found he was liable for sexual assault, and the legal definition of that is that he was liable for raping her, but also that he defamed her and defamed her. So I think in that case, you want to know that she's going to get her money. But I think with the New York Attorney General, she has the resources and the powers. She can get liens on all these buildings. She can say, right, you know, he can't sell that. He can't sell anything. I can freeze all this stuff until he pays this fine if it's upheld by the court. She doesn't necessarily have to have the money in the bank, because, as I say, her reach is so much more powerful than any Jean Carroll or an individual plaintiff. So she could say, okay, you know what, stop whining, go and you know, here's another 30 days, go and find the damn money. Or she could say, okay, you know what, give us 100 million. Or, you know, this will be resolved. Or Trump, because apparently his Truth Social is about to land him. But if you ignore all the legal shenanigans that are going on in the background, this is about to potentially land him $3.5 billion, a little bit of a windfall. So I don't think him crying boo-hoo, I've no money, is going to wash. But this is all very humiliating for Trump, because remember, the big myth is that he's this billionaire, he's got so many billions he can't count them, and now he's saying, I'm going to have to sell all my properties I can't afford to do this, etc. So, you know, which one are you going to pick? Is he the big, brilliant, successful man, or is he this kind of relative church mouse?
Whatever suits.
Who has got an arf in his trousers.
Yeah, whatever suits the predicament he finds himself in. Yeah. You know, just in the same way as he's pro-life when he's around pro-life people. I love a better podcast, Marian, is that as much as I love listening to you and Cal Thomas on Today FM, it's so brief and snappy. But here we can actually dig a little bit deeper. And I wanted to pick up on one thing there that you said. And that was the idea that it was excessive. The example we gave was if Willy Wonka did the same thing, if he fiddled the books, inflated the value of the Wonka factory, stole some fizzy lifting drinks, whatever it is, we would think that's a bit much, because now we're never going to have Wonka bars again. And, you know, we'll probably ruin the business. What is the argument for this
analogy, by the way?
What is the argument for this being excessive? This man enriched himself to the tune of a fantastical amount and conned a lot of people and a lot of banks out of a lot of money. Why shouldn't the fine be a lot of money?
Right. And I, you know, there is absolutely that point. But should the fine, there should be a fine. And I don't think anyone's disputing that. But given that the banks were repaid all of their money, the fraud was, no bank was left out of pocket. Donald Trump agreed a rate with these banks, an interest rate, and it was all repaid in full. So he can say, this was a deal between me and the banks. And, you know, they can go, sure, maybe I exaggerated the size of my whatever, you know, a penthouse. But so what? I paid them back.
Yeah, no harm, no foul.
That's pretty much his line. Yeah. No, and, you know, it is not a no harm, no foul, because it was fraudulent. But at the same time, is it such a harm that it merits a $500 million fine? Because there has really never been a fine like this in New York business history. And there have been, quite honestly and quite objectively, I think, more egregious frauds and transgressions in New York's very storied commercial world. So, you know, I think that if you do sort of cool your jets on this and you take Trump out of the equation, which we have to do, you've got to be objective. You've got to be objective, because otherwise, you know, it you fall into that horrible, you know, thing that, well, if it's Trump, you know, it's there's got to be one law. There's got to be one application of the law for everyone, regardless. And I just happen to think that now the way he behaved during the trial obviously didn't help him. I don't think the judge was minded to cut him a break at all. But again, that's not the issue. The issue is, what did he do? And, you know, does this fraud, does what he did? And he did it over decades. So he certainly should receive a substantial fine, you know, many, many millions, many tens of millions, maybe even a couple of hundred million. But should it be that much?
Well, you're asking us to be objective, and that's the opposite of what he is throughout every interaction at the moment. He seems on a spiral, on a bender.
But that's the risk, that people take his cue. You know, it's like, well, he's crazy, so why should we?
Yeah, why should
not,
we be?
You know,
yeah,
be crazy exactly. with him? And I think that's a real race to the bottom.
Let me ask you this question about probably his most incendiary comments this week. And sometimes, Marian, do you ever find yourself going, how are we still talking about this guy? Like you say,
tell me about it.
Lay out exactly how many times he's lost, there was this moment when he got elected, but ever since he's been consistently losing, whether it's in court or at the ballot box. But yet we have to deal with it until November and maybe beyond. This week, he says, now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole, that's the going to be the least of it. This is a direct quote. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. And he suggests that there may not be another election after this election. Talk to me about what's been the reaction to those remarks and what's your reaction to those remarks?
Okay, my reaction to those remarks is, now I, sadly for my sins, saw that speech and the context in which it was delivered. And I think what Trump does really cunningly, and I think this is his sort of evil genius, if you will, is that he knows how to phrase things, and he has done it over and over and over again to the point of, oh my God, over the last 8 to 10 years, where he will say something and he'll phrase it in such a way that it's like, oh my God, huge headline sensation, and we all run after that shiny thing. And then he'll go, well, I was talking about in the context of the car industry. And if you look at the way he spoke about it, you can plausibly say that. You can say, okay, we know that he was trying to get a rise out of the opposition. We know he was trying to make a headline there, but he couched it in a way where he could say, what are you all talking about? I was talking about that if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the auto industry because of all these Chinese cars coming over the border.
We're going to put a 100% tariff on every single car that comes across the line, and you're not going to be able to sell those cars if I get elected. Now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole... That's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it.
So I think that in a way, the media is being really foolish, because when you jump up and down at every single thing, you're doing his bidding.
Yeah.
You're doing precisely what he wants. And yeah, and they take the bait every bloody time. Now, he has said plenty of things that are appalling and egregious. There is no taking out of context what he said about Jewish Democrats hating Israel and hating their religion. That to me was infinitely, infinitely worse. He used to do, when he'd talk about people, and mock people, and he'd go, I was only being sarcastic, I was only joking,
Yeah, you guys have got no sense of humor. People, yeah.
Yeah, people need to stop giving him oxygen. The media has him on a life support machine. It's pumping oxygen for everything he says. And, I think that this hysteria is all a bit wearing, and it's wearing for the public as well. So I think that there needs to be, it's depressing to me that what he would call the mainstream media, but the reputable news organizations, have learned so little from the way they covered him in 2016.
Well, let's talk about a more serious thing. Like, if we're not going to take the bait ourselves, let's talk about something a bit more important. And that is
right.
SB4, the Texas immigration law. Now, not everybody will be following this story. I don't feel like it's getting a load of airtime over here. Maybe you can break it down for us.
Okay. Now, I'm going to preface this, Jarla, by saying that to me, and I'm writing about this week in the Business Post, presidents come and go. Can America withstand a second Donald Trump term and the stress test to its democratic institutions? Honestly, I don't know, but I suspect maybe if Democrats hold Congress, and if, all things considered, it might just sneak through another Trump term. It will be horrible, but it might be okay. To me, the Supreme Court is a far bigger threat to American democracy at the moment because of the way it operates, because of the way it's willing to trample any precedent, any law, because of the way it's willing to muddy the separation of powers, the checks and balances system, everything, just in the pursuit of its own narrow ideological goals, which are to bring America back to 1950, when white men ran the show and we all knew our places. So now that's just to frame this SB4 law. Now, I'm going to do a little teeny short history lesson here. Cast your minds back to 2021. Okay, you may remember SB8 in Texas. SB8 in Texas was this crazy abortion bill, which said that any person anywhere in America could come to Texas and could launch a civil suit against anyone who helped a woman to obtain the abortion after 6 weeks, whether it was the Uber driver who drove her to the clinic, whether it was the receptionist who checked her in, whether it was her sister who loaned her the money for the procedure. And it said, you can sue anyone. You can sue all of them. Knock yourselves out. Have at it. And what's more, this law will cover your legal fees. It was a crazy, insane law, but it was the canary in the coal mine. It floated a balloon up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, whoops, now we can't really look at this law, even though we know it was deliberately framed in such a way to be able to evade judicial review in the Supreme Court. So they said, well, we can't really stop this going into effect, which was absurd because they should have said, we see what you're doing there. We see the device you're using, but and we are not going to fall for it, which they've done in plenty of other cases. So that sent a signal then. Look, we're open to overturn Roe v. Wade. So somebody bring us a decent case we can work with. And of course, then we had Mississippi going, oh, yes, yes, over here. Here's the Dobbs case. This is perfect for you. And then they were able to use the Dobbs case to overturn Roe v. Wade, to strip away the constitutional protections that were imposed half a century ago and recognized for women to have control over their own bodies. Yep. And so that was what happened there. Now, this to me looks almost exactly the same. So you have this law, and sorry for taking so long to get to what you asked me.
No, not at all.
You have this law, SB4. It is an appalling, brutal, and cruel law. And it does so many things that are fundamentally wrong. The first one is, and this needs to be made really clear, since 1891, it has been absolutely accepted by every Supreme Court that's reviewed it, most recently in 2012, that only the federal government has the right to control the borders. Only the federal government can make and enforce immigration law and policy. States can have no role, because if you were to allow states to have a role, you would have chaos. So California is doing one thing, Arizona is doing another, Texas is doing another, and up on the northern border, Washington State's doing one thing, New York's doing another, Montana's doing another. It would be insanity. And as well, again, legal wonk alert here, it also ties into America's right to conduct foreign policy and negotiate treaties and, you know, and conduct its business according to those treaties. And America is a treaty to laws, international laws on asylum. This Texas law says anyone who enters Texas illegally, anyone, regardless of whether they're asylum seekers, whether they're coming over looking for work, whatever, that they are subject to arrest. And the thing is, it's a law, it's a racial profiling law as well, because it's like, who are they going to go after for this? They're going to go after brown people. They're going to go after dark-skinned people. They're going to go after people who don't speak English, who are in Texas. So, and there are millions of Mexicans living in Texas legally who are brown-skinned, who will become targets of this racial profiling. Some of them may have family members who aren't legal, so it's going to cause chaos on that level. But what the law is saying basically is, you've committed a crime. We're arresting you. We're going to take you to jail, and you are either going to be deported immediately by a state judge, or you're going to go to jail for up to 20 years. Now, if you think about the number of people coming over the border every day, and it is several thousand most days, how are they going to even enforce that? Now, we had a situation, oh my God, Gerald, it was so appalling, in January, where you had a young mother, 33-year-old mother, and her two young children, I think 7 and 9 or 8 and 10 years of age. And they were trying to cross the Rio Grande in Eagle Park, in a portion of the Rio Grande that is part of a Texas public park. Now, the Texas state troopers went down there and they wouldn't allow the Border Patrol people, whose right it is to man the borders, they wouldn't let them enter. There was a standoff. And they wouldn't let them enter. And when this woman and her two children got into difficulties crossing the river, they refused to let them save them. And this woman and her two young children drowned. And that's just one example of the chaos and the craziness that's happening in Texas at the moment. And they admitted it. They're like, this is not, you know, the Border Patrol people. I spoke with Border Patrol people the last time I was down there who told me they contemplated suicide, because a lot of these are good, decent people who have empathy, who understand that the border is a mess, but they do not want to see women and children being treated worse than animals. They do not want to see, you know, babies getting caught in barbed wire. They do not want to see a woman got caught in barbed wire and suffered a miscarriage while she was trapped in it. You know, I've been told about these things, and it's just appalling. But the Texas state law would basically say, you know, the Border Patrol, the federal agents have no say in this. We're going to run this border as we see fit, and we're going to use our National Guard, our soldiers, our troops, our sheriffs, everyone we want at state level to enforce this. But where would they even put these people? If they're going to be arresting 5,000 people a day, where are they going to detain them? you know, where are these court cases going to take place? What is the mechanism for deportation? And the Mexican government has said, we're not taking them. We're not taking them back. Thank you very much. There's no way a state in America is going to tell us what to do. And so you have this appalling situation. Now, the fact that the Supreme Court, so what happened was the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals is one of the most conservative in America, if not the most conservative. So a lower court Texas judge immediately said, this law is bullshit. We're not, this isn't enforceable. This is unconstitutional. It was appealed. It went to the Fifth Circuit. And the Fifth Circuit said, okay, we're going to hear the appeal. But you know what? We're going to let the law take place now. Anyway, exactly as they did with the SB8 abortion law. Exactly as they did with that. And then it went to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, which to me was unbelievable on Tuesday, went, well, there's nothing we can do. So I guess, yeah, Texas, you're okay. Go ahead and impose this law, knowing it was unconstitutional, knowing there's 133 years of settled law that only the federal government can enforce immigration policy. And they were that willing. And as well, the other thing about this that I find so disturbing is these people then have no remedy. So let's say the appeals court, so let's say this law went into effect, and it did for a couple of hours. And then the appeals courts go, oh, you know what, actually, this law is unconstitutional. What happens then to those people who are arrested, forcibly deported, or put in prison? What's their remedy? You know, they don't have one. And that's why normally when you have a situation like that, the court will keep the status quo in place. It'll say, OK, you know what, we're going to look at this, but for now, we're not changing anything because this change would be so seismic and so catastrophic that we can't do it until we know it's, you know, until we've made a definite ruling. So instead of that, the Supreme Court did exactly what it did in SB 8, where it said, oh, whoops, you know, you've said that this is an administrative stay that's allowing you to put this law in place. And we don't really look at administrative stays. So have at it, Texas. You know, bring in this state law, cause chaos, and we'll get around to reviewing it fully at some point in the future. And, you know, so this to me is the signal from the Supreme Court again, just like it was with the SB 8 abortion law. We're ready. We're ready to take a second look at this. We might be ready to just say, no, actually, the federal government doesn't have this right. So bring us your case, you know, Arizona or Texas or whoever wants, and we'll take a look at this. And the last time the Supreme Court looked at this was in 2012 in Arizona, when Arizona tried to introduce a sort of pretty banal law that had to do with to do with papers and the sort of administrative aspect of illegal migrants crossing. And the court said, no, you can't touch. And the Supreme Court said, can't touch immigration law, can't touch it. That's the federal court's jurisdiction. But it seems to me now that the Supreme Court, and they have hinted at this, that they will, if they get the opportunity, actually cause the same kind of chaos as they did with overturning Roe v. Wade, where they just threw the whole thing to the states and said, have at it, do whatever you want. Because that would further their narrow ideological goal of keeping America white. And really, I do believe that that's what this is all about, that they are absolutely implacably opposed to having an America where there are more brown, black people, that where the white majority is no longer an absolute white majority.
But surely there isn't a white majority in America. Am I asking a silly question there? Like, surely that like time is the biggest factor for change there, that this is the melting pot. There are so many ethnicities in America now that I doubt that many of those on the Supreme Court couldn't find some different form of ethnicity in their heritage. That's my first question. My second question is, how aware of what you're discussing here do you feel the rest of America is? Is this very much a political anorax discussion, or does America feel completely alienated by this court that's pulling all these strings and, as you say, maybe the most dangerous force for change in America right now?
Yeah, okay. The first thing is that apparently all of the demographics suggest that this Generation Z is going to be our Z. Sorry about that. Yep. Whoops. Is going to be the last generation of Americans that will be a white majority. That by about 2045, the number of non-Hispanic white people will fall below half of the overall number of the US population.
Yeah.
So it will still be the biggest plurality, but it won't be a majority in another 20 years. And this is what all of these Tucker Carlsons and all of these far-right extremists have been yelling and jumping up and down about nonstop. Now, on to the question about the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, I mean, we've seen their ideology. We've seen that they are willing to do whatever it takes to further their ideological aims. We've seen it with gun control. We've seen it with affirmative action. We've seen it now with the way that they're trying to strip government agencies of the power. Like, you know, agencies like the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, where they want to be able to come in and go, well, we don't agree that this medicine should be taken this way, because of course we know everything about this because we're Supreme Court judges, where they want to substitute the opinion of experts and scientists for their opinion. And this is a really, again, this is all chipping away at democracy, in my view, in a really egregious way. And yet the most important probably part of your question is, what does America think of this? Two parts to this. Immigration is the biggest issue on the 2024 election agenda, and Donald Trump has made damn sure of that. And that is why they would not let Biden's law, the bipartisan immigration law that was crafted in the Senate by Republicans and Democrats, they wouldn't let it near the floor of the Congress, the House of Representatives, because had that passed, it would have taken Trump's, apart from his retribution and revenge tour, it would have taken the only issue that he's really running on, that he's going to just have mass deportations on day one. So Americans are really upset and concerned about immigration at the moment. It is for them, along with the economy, the biggest issue. And a lot of Americans have become really far right on this. But then you have the piece about the Supreme Court. If you look at the Supreme Court was the one institution in America that was kind of untouchable. Like, you know, everybody thought Congress was rubbish. You had crazy presidents. The media was not trusted anymore, you know, and all the other various institutions were treated with skepticism. But the Supreme Court always had a place of kind of reverence and respect. And that's gone. That's gone since this new court, since the Trump three appointees came onto it. So if you look now at, do people, when they're asked, do they trust the court? Do they approve of it? The ratings are the lowest they've ever been in the court's history. And this is precisely why, because they see that the court is no longer a Supreme Court. It's always been political. You know, we saw Bush v. Gore back in 2000. That was one of the worst decisions that was ever made, followed by Citizens United in 2012, which basically handed US elections over to corporate donors and big business and billionaires. It's made lots of terrible, very politically motivated decisions. But what it has done in the last 4 years or thereabouts, it just pales into in comparison. And this is what I'm saying. This is an institution of democracy that's self-cannibalizing, that's choosing to discredit itself for short-term ideological goals.
Well, it is a strange week in Irish politics too. Leo Varadkar resigns yes. this week after his speech at the yeah. White House, and a week in which he was praised across the pond for his speech and how he handled a very delicate situation. We're going to talk a bit more about that in the second half of the show. We're also going to talk about Senator Marco Rubio enters the building. Is he going to be Trump's
Not
running
for long.
Mate? Who knows? Marion does come on over to patreon.com/Irishman Abroad. We're going to talk about potential Trump running mates, Leo Varadkar, and a little bit more about
immigration. I don't think Leo Varadkar is a potential Trump running mate.
Who knows? Who knows, Mary?
Although the way things are going, wouldn't that be a turn up for the books?
You can hear the rest of the conversation every single week on patreon.com/Irishman Abroad. Since we last spoke, Marion, I announced shows in Boston. I announced one show on the show on here on the podcast 2 weeks ago that sold out, and we added another and then another, and all of those sold out. So we're going to Chicago now because we've just run out of space in Boston. There's a show at the Den Theater in the Den Theater on the 30th of October, and I've just found out before I came on here that there's basically no seats left there. There's only obstructed view and back row single seats. So I think we're going to be adding a second Chicago show. And for those that have been asking, the New York City show at the Gramercy Theatre will be on sale the first week in April. I cannot wait to do this. I am, of course, a final plug, running the London Marathon on April 21st. And I would love if you would support me. And I'll include the link in the bio for that.
Ready? You have the cameras rolling? This is
America. A lot of people who would probably consider themselves liberal have done very well financially under the Donald Trump 4 years.
You encouraged espionage against our people.
You condemn any interference by Russia in the American election.
By Russia or anybody else.
Russia, please, if you can, get us Hillary Clinton's emails. Please, Russia, please.
To renew America, we must revitalize our democracy.